državni izpitni center.
Splošna matura 2011.
Preverjanje slušnega razumevanja.
Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje maturitetne izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine.
Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali, nato boste poslušali besedilo in lahko že med poslušanjem nalogo sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak.
Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, vpisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Po reševanju obeh delov, dela A in dela B, boste imeli minuto časa, da izpolnite še list za odgovore pri nalogi A. Če boste pri tej nalogi pri posameznih postavkah izbrali več odgovorov, bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha.
Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with John Simpson, a BBC reporter, discussing his latest book. As you listen to the recording, tick the appropriate column below, then complete the answer sheet according to the instructions on it. You will hear the recording twice. Now read through the statements.
Hello, Richard.
Welcome to the program. Nice to see
you.
And you have a new book out, which I think is your sixth book.
Depends how you count it.
And it's about the development of the reporter's art over the last 100 years, which is a fascinating topic. And you go from the Boer War till today. But even within your own career, some of those changes have been dramatic, haven't they?
They've been dramatic in all sorts of ways. I mean, the world's changed for a start, because I started reporting for television in 1978, having started reporting generally in 68. World changed. That we take that for granted. BBC's changed enormously. It always makes me slightly amused when people say, BBC is not, it used to be so wonderful in the news. Actually, it wasn't that fantastically great. BBC television news was always behind ITN, or never as good as ITN. It was a small-time organisation. I mean, we had 3 foreign correspondents across the face of the globe. Now it must be, 50 or 60 or something like that. And the BBC, of course, is now the biggest news broadcaster in the world. And that's a change I still find difficult when I...
Is that a good thing?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a good thing for Britain, because it means that Britain's voice is heard on a scale that nobody would ever have thought of, I think, before. I don't know. I find it scary. I mean, when I do a report, the chances are for the television news, chances are it's going to be listened to by maybe 300 million people altogether. Mm. That's something to make you worry.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's a demonstration or a reminder of the potential influence that someone like you has, because people are hearing about these major events through you. You're the prism, the window through which they understand these events.
Yes, I dare say that is true. Of course, if you start to think about that, you go balmy. You have to, I think, and I'm certain that all my colleagues would see it this way. You mustn't ever think about that you're broadcasting often to people that loathe what you're saying or have absolutely ferocious views about it, or whatever, whatever it may be. I think you just have to kind of shut your eyes and go straight for what you believe, stroke know, to be true. And if you do that, then you've at least you've got your own defence. Yeah. You know, when you get attacked, as you get attacked so often nowadays.
Of course. And also, thinking of the vast numbers of people watching or listening is never helpful, because it's meant to be an intimate relationship that you have with an audience. Mm. And they always say, think of one person. Mm. I think I've probably presented some radio programmes where it's almost literally been one person.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Hello, Richard.
Welcome to the programme. Nice to see
you.
And you have a new book out, which I think is your sixth book.
Yes, depends how you count it.
And it's about the development of the reporter's art over the last 100 years, which is a fascinating topic. And you go from the Boer War till today. But even within your own career, some of those changes have been dramatic, haven't they?
They've been dramatic in all sorts of ways. I mean, the world's changed for a start, because I started reporting for television in 1978, having started reporting generally in really 68. World changed. That we take that for granted. BBC's changed enormously. It always makes me slightly amused when people say, BBC is not, it used to be so wonderful in the news. Actually, it wasn't that fantastically great. BBC television news was always behind ITN, or never as good as ITN. It was a small-time organisation. I mean, we had 3 foreign correspondents across the face of the globe. Now it must be, 50 or 60 or something like that. And the BBC, of course, is now the biggest news broadcaster in the world. And that's a change I still find difficult.
Is that a good thing?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a good thing for Britain, because it means that Britain's voice is heard on a scale that nobody would ever have thought of, I think, before. I don't know. I find it scary. I mean, when I do a report, the chances are for the television news, chances are it's going to be listened to by maybe 300 million people altogether. Mm. That's something to make you worry.
It's a demonstration or a reminder of the potential influence that someone like you has, because people are hearing about these major events through you. You're the prism, the window through which they understand these events.
Yes, I dare say that is true. Of course, if you start to think about that, you go balmy. You have to, I think, and I'm certain that all my colleagues would see it this way. You mustn't ever think about that you're broadcasting often to people that loathe what you're saying or have absolutely ferocious views about it, or whatever, whatever it may be. I think you just have to kind of shut your eyes and go straight for what you believe, stroke know, to be true. And if you do that, then you've at least you've got your own defence. Yeah. You know, when you get attacked, as you get attacked so often nowadays.
Of course. And also, thinking of the vast numbers of people watching or listening is never helpful, because it's meant to be an intimate relationship that you have with an audience. Yeah. And they always say, think of one person. Yeah. I think I've probably presented some radio programmes where it's almost literally been one person. No.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Dr. Arthur Fournier. As you listen to the recording, write your answers in note form in the spaces below. Use 1 to 5 words for each answer. You will hear the recording twice. Now read through the questions.
First, amidst the death and destruction caused by the earthquake in Haiti, there have been some amazing stories of survival against all the odds. One of the most miraculous is the tale of a tiny baby called Jenny. 5 days after the quake, she was brought to an American field hospital, still alive but suffering from terrible injuries. The medical team, led by Dr. Arthur Fournier, realized that her only hope of survival was to be airlifted to an intensive care hospital in the United States. But the U.S. government had banned earthquake victims from being flown to the U.S. Undaunted, Dr. Fournier set about saving Jenny's life and finally, earlier this week, reuniting her with her parents. When I spoke to Dr. Fournier on the line from Washington, D.C., he described the conditions his volunteer medical team faced just after the earthquake.
Primitive doesn't do it justice. We were in a tent, actually two tents, inside the United Nations compound. So we had 300 patients critically ill in the tent at the time. We had no running water. We had no toilets. We had medicines and supplies and volunteers that were flying in on shuttle jets from the United States. It was pretty much chaos.
And what state was Jenny in when she was brought to you?
She was near death. She had a depressed skull fracture. She had what we call a flail chest. She had enough broken ribs on either side of her sternum that when she tried to breathe in, her chest would collapse. She had compromised circulation in both of her arms. She had a blood sugar of 30, which is a fraction of what it should be. She had a pulse of 60. She had a weakness on one side of her face. She was 2 feet in the grave.
So what made you think that there could be something that could be done for her under those terrible circumstances you were working in and with those terrible injuries?
Well, we were blessed to have a wonderful pediatrician, a pediatric intensive care unit nurse, and an obstetrician who's also trained in infant resuscitation, who happened to be at the right place at the right time. We also had the equipment we needed, and we're trained to perform a resuscitation on a child like this. Usually, if a child in this condition gets in the hands of a competent team such as we had, you can bring them back. And indeed, we did. But the problem was we knew that if we kept her in Haiti, eventually she'd succumb to her injury. She needed a pediatric intensive care unit. I was the most senior physician on site, and we had to make a decision. And I knew that we had a plane that was scheduled to come in, but I didn't know if indeed it came in on time or that we could get the baby there or that the pilot would even accept her.
Because of course, there was a ban, wasn't there, on taking people from Haiti to the United States for treatment?
Absolutely. Only U.S. citizens were allowed to be evacuated. And the airport was shut down, except it was surrounded by the military, basically, as a security issue. The U.N. compound was about a kilometer and a half from the airport, not that far distance-wise, but had to pass through two checkpoints, had to convince a military person at the airport checkpoint to let me in. And he had to escort me as I ran, and he followed in full military regalia to the plane, spoke with the pilot. Pilot said, if you get back in 15 minutes, you can go. But the military controlled the airport, and they only gave each plane coming in a half an hour to get rid of their passengers, their cargo, and to reload and then leave. So
you had to dash back from the airport to the hospital to get Jenny.
Now you will hear the recording again.
First, amidst the death and destruction caused by the earthquake in Haiti, there have been some amazing stories of survival against all the odds. One of the most miraculous is the tale of a tiny baby called Jenny. 5 days after the quake, she was brought to an American field hospital, still alive but suffering from terrible injuries. The medical team, led by Dr. Arthur Fournier, realized that her only hope of survival was to be airlifted to an intensive care hospital in the United States. But the U.S. government had banned earthquake victims from being flown to the U.S. Undaunted, Dr. Fournier set about saving Jenny's life and finally, earlier this week, reuniting her with her parents. When I spoke to Dr. Fournier on the line from Washington, D.C., he described the conditions his volunteer medical team faced just after the earthquake.
Primitive doesn't do it justice. We were in a tent, actually two tents, inside the United Nations compound. So we had 300 patients critically ill in the tent at the time. We had no running water. We had no toilets. We had medicines and supplies and volunteers that were flying in on shuttle jets from the United States. It was pretty much chaos.
And what state was Jenny in when she was brought to you?
She was near death. She had a depressed skull fracture. She had what we call a flail chest. She had enough broken ribs on either side of her sternum that when she tried to breathe in, her chest would collapse. She had compromised circulation in both of her arms. She had a blood sugar of 30, which is a fraction of what it should be. She had a pulse of 60. She had a weakness on one side of her face. She was 2 feet in the grave.
So what made you think that there could be something that could be done for her under those terrible circumstances you were working in and with those terrible injuries?
Well, we were blessed to have a wonderful pediatrician, a pediatric intensive care unit nurse, and an obstetrician who's also trained in infant resuscitation, who happened to be at the right place at the right time. We also had the equipment we needed, and we're trained to perform a resuscitation on a child like this. Usually, if a child in this condition gets in the hands of a competent team such as we had, you can bring them back. And indeed, we did. But the problem was we knew that if we kept her in Haiti, eventually she'd succumb to her injury. She needed a pediatric intensive care unit. I was the most senior physician on site, and we had to make a decision. And I knew that we had a plane that was scheduled to come in, but I didn't know if indeed it came in on time or that we could get the baby there or that the pilot would even accept her.
Because of course, there was a ban, wasn't there, on taking people from Haiti to the United States for treatment?
Absolutely. Only U.S. citizens were allowed to be evacuated. And the airport was shut down, except it was surrounded by the military, basically, as a security issue. The U.N. compound was about a kilometer and a half from the airport, not that far distance-wise, but had to pass through two checkpoints, had to convince a military person at the airport checkpoint to let me in. And he had to escort me as I ran, and he followed in full military regalia to the plane, spoke with the pilot. Pilot said, if you get back in 15 minutes, you can go. But the military controlled the airport, and they only gave each plane coming in a half an hour to get rid of their passengers, their cargo, and to reload and then leave.
So you had to dash back from the airport to the hospital to get Jenny.
This is the end of section B.
Zdaj imate še minuto časa, da izpolnite list za odgovore pri nalogi A.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z listom za odgovore položite na rob mize.
Na svidenje in srečno.